All right, our next case is 11-2043, Cincinnati Bar Association versus Curtis Britt. For the relator, Mr. Smith.
May it please the court, my name is Philip Smith, and I appear on behalf of the relator, the Cincinnati Bar Association, along with my co-counsel, Robert Gehring, and we'd like to reserve 3 minutes for Mr. Gehring to present a rebuttal. We're here today before the court on the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and the recommended sanction from the Board of Commissioners on Grievances and Discipline, who recommended an indefinite suspension as to the respondent, Curtis Britt. We aren't before the court lightly in objecting to that recommendation. We recognize that seeking disbarment for the respondent is a severe sanction, the most severe that this court can impose. But we do so because it is consistent with this court's precedent, which holds that the presumptive sanction is disbarment for an attorney's misappropriation of client funds and failure to perform the work of the retention. And additionally, because this court's overriding purpose in imposing discipline is the protection of the public. We believe that to protect the public, Mr. Britt should be disbarred. The precedent of this court makes clear that the acceptance of a retainer and failing to carry out the engagement is tantamount to theft. Because it is theft, the presumptive sanction is disbarment. In this case, the undisputed record is that Mr. Britt took more than $40,000 in total from 42 clients over the course of 2 years. During our initial investigation to the first complaint that we received from a client, he was not forthcoming in disclosing that he was misappropriating funds, nor did he stop in misappropriating client retainers or their filing fees that had been paid to him. These clients, because 95% of his practice is dedicated to bankruptcy, were among the most vulnerable who could present to an attorney. They were indigent. They were in severe economic straits. They came to him looking for help, for relief from those circumstances. He failed to do their work and used the funds for his own purposes. He failed to communicate with them, and he's provided, in our view, no meaningful restitution. These practices with respect to the 42 clients were further marked by additional violations of the rules of professional conduct, including assisting in the unauthorized practice of law by a member of his staff, and his retention of an unreasonable fee. So consistent with the clear interest in protecting the public, the appropriate sanction in this case should be disbarment. I mentioned the court's precedent a moment ago, and in our brief, we cited 6 cases from this court over the past decade in which the sanction of disbarment has been imposed. The Weaver case, the Cornett case, Bursey, Marshall, Henry, and the court's decision in Toledo Bar Association versus Mason. The court's holding there was that disbarment is generally the sanction when a lawyer's neglect of a client's case is coupled with misappropriation of the client's money and other professional misconduct. We submit that that's the standard that should guide the court in this case. The court has indeed deviated to lesser sanctions in certain cases, consistent with its ability to weigh the circumstances and to protect the public. But it seems to have done so when there are factors that are not present, as in this case. For example, long years, indeed decades worth of meritorious service before the bar without a disciplinary history, a substantial disabling illness or substance abuse that renders the attorney incapable of providing service, meaningful character testimony from professional colleagues and from members of the bench who can testify favorably to the respondent's character and their ability to return to diligent practice, and when there's no client harm. As I indicate, none of those factors are present in this case that would warrant a downward departure from the presumptive sanction of disbarment. I want to discuss, because the court always weighs the aggravating and mitigating circumstances, the aggravating conduct in this case. Here, the board recognized that there were 3 significant aggravating factors. One of them was the pattern of misconduct Another was multiple offenses. And the third was the harm to the vulnerable clients. And in particular, these are laid out in Exhibit D to the stipulations before the board, which show the payments that were made to Mr. Britt that he misapplied and misappropriated.
Has there been restitution paid to any of them?
Justice O'Donnell, there has only been partial restitution. Of the 42 clients, the testimony before the board was that 12 of them had elected to pursue services through another attorney that Mr. Britt had identified. His arrangement with that attorney is that he is paying over the client funds that he accepted on behalf of those 12 clients to that attorney over time through a promissory arrangement. For the other 30 clients, there has been no restitution that has been made.
There's some suggestion that Mr. Britt is employed at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base and has agreed to make some payments. Have there been any of those paid into any funds, to your knowledge, up to this point?
The record only substantiates that he has made payments to the other practitioner, but no payments have been made to the other 30 clients who have been aggrieved. And that includes the initial client who came to us, Sonia Weaver, who had complained about receiving defective advice from Mr. Britt's assistant, who told her to quit her part-time job, who told her to stop making payments on her credit card. Mr. Britt has stipulated that Mr. Cooper, the assistant, had engaged in the unauthorized practice, and he only made a partial refund of Ms. Weaver's fee to her. She's only received $499 back out of more than $1,000 that she paid to Mr. Britt. Even though she was the one who initially complained in 2009, she's still without any additional remedy.
And what likelihood of recovery for any of those clients if we adopt your recommendation for disbarment and would then change the recommendation of the board, which was, I believe, yes, it was an indefinite suspension?
The record in this case, Justice, is that Mr. Britt does have his employment at the Air Force Base. That does not depend on his having a law license. So whether this court disbars him, we're led to believe that that will not impact that position, and that is one of two sources of funding that he has. Another one is a military pension. Altogether, the record substantiates that he's making more than $100,000 a year. So we would anticipate that he should be able to continue to make restitution to those clients going forward, even if he is disbarred.
Counsel, there's no mitigation here that he's suffering from substance abuse or major mental illness or anything that triggered this behavior.
That's correct, Chief Justice. There was evidence below as to his going to Dr. Mossman for a diagnosis.
That's subsequent to, I mean, he's depressed and you know, with good cause, but it wasn't something that triggered his activity.
Correct, Your Honor. And Dr. Mossman found that there was no causal link between the depression that he was suffering and his ability to carry out his failure to carry out his duties as a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
So there is not a substantial mitigation as there was in some of the cases where this court has deviated from the presumptive sanction of disbarment.
But is he still a member in good standing in Kentucky?
Your Honor, our latest information is that he is. He had been suspended for a time due to,
non-registration problems, but, you know,
I believe he's been restored.
Okay. But he's not practicing in Kentucky. Is that true?
Yes. And the latest information at the hearing, the record indicates that he has ceased his practice of law other than for the receipt of some funds on ongoing bankruptcy matters where he is continuing a counseling role. And I believe that those funds
He's continuing in a counseling role on some cases.
Before the United States Bankruptcy Court in Ohio. And my understanding is that in certain of those cases, there's a continuing obligation to
I thought he turned his responsibilities over to, is it Mr. Ziccarelli's something?
He did for the 42 clients for whom he performed no services, but we're led to believe that there's a small number of clients on which there's some additional ongoing work required from his initial appearance in the bankruptcy court. And those fees would be subject to the IRS's lien upon any earnings that he gets from his bankruptcy practice. In addition to the aggravating factors that the board found, we would submit that there's an additional aggravating factor that the board did not reach, and that is with respect to the selfish and dishonest motive. The board, in our view, should have found that there was a selfish purpose because the funds were taken for his personal use. The respondent here contends that he did not convert client funds for his personal use. That's page 8 of his brief. However, that's contrary to the stipulated facts of record that he did divert the funds for his own use. And in his testimony before the board, he testified that even though he reduced the draw that he was taking out of the client funds that had gone into his operating account after 2009, he still testified at page 58 of the record that he continued to make draws when he had a mortgage payment, car payment, or a need for operating cash for himself. So this was, in fact, diverted for his personal use. And the record, moreover, shows that he continued to take money after the investigation began. We first deposed the respondent in February of 2010, and at that point, we had not yet reached a concern with respect to misappropriation of funds. But even though he was undergoing a pending investigation, he took money from 5 different clients during the course of June and July of 2010, totaling some $3,500. He did that even though he testified before the board that he recognized at the start of June 2010 that his practice was failed. It was doomed. The IRS had levied upon any payments that he was to receive in bankruptcy court. He knew that there was no prospect for his being able to carry on and pay the client filing fees that he had misappropriated. Nevertheless, he continued to take client funds. So we believe that there's significant aggravating conduct in this case. With respect to mitigation, Your Honors, the board did discuss the restitutionary arrangement that he has with the other practitioner. Again, we would submit that that still leaves 30 clients for whom there is no restitution. Under the board's rule, mitigation should be considered when it's the result of a timely, good faith effort to make restitution or rectify the consequences of misconduct. In this case, it's not a timely effort to make restitution. Some of these clients were paying funds to Mr. Britt as far back as 2008, and most of them in 2009. They still have no restitution. I want to make sure that I reserve time for Mr. Gehring, but in summary, Your Honors, this is a case in which the rule should apply rather than the exception. The presumptive sanction is disbarment. This is a wide array of clients were affected, some 42, significant losses of $40,000. And this case is far different from the cases with lesser harm, lesser impact, in which the court has deviated and imposed an indefinite sanction. Thank you very much.
Mr. Gehring, you have less than no. Mr. Gehring has about 2.5 minutes left for rebuttal, I'm presuming, correct?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
May it please the Court. My name is George Johnson, and I represent the respondent, Curtis Britt. We respectfully submit that the board recommendation of an indefinite suspension is appropriate. This case is very different than almost any other disciplinary case that I've seen in Ohio, in that while the respondent did misappropriate client funds, he did it negligently and not intentionally. And by intentionally, I mean he didn't commit intentional wrongful conduct. This was a man who was in the U.S. Air Force for 20 years, was honorably discharged, went to law school late in life. Upon graduation from law school, he was employed in private practice by 3 different law firms from 1999 to 2007, and his last firm was a title company, and he was let go because of the downturn in the housing market. He went into solo practice for himself for a number of months, and that was the first time that he ever had an IOLTA account, and he used it on one occasion to take client funds that were to be distributed to a creditor and to pay those funds and remit the remainder to his client. He went to work for a bankruptcy firm for 6 weeks. He knew nothing about bankruptcy law, and he quit that bankruptcy firm when they missed 2 out of his 3 pay periods. What he learned at that bankruptcy firm was nothing about bankruptcy, but a little bit about how these flat fees were to be handled. The previous firm and Mr. Britt both charged these bankruptcy clients a $1,000 flat fee plus filing fees. There wasn't an IOLTA account at the – he worked for an Indianapolis firm who opened a Cincinnati office. He was the only employee in that office for 6 weeks. So when clients gave a retainer check to him as an associate of Bradburn Law, he took it to the bank and put it in the operating account as per the instructions of Mr. Bradburn. From that, he incorrectly concluded that these were flat fee cases and it was appropriate to put the money in his operating account. So he leaves Bradburn Law, and the office manager from Bradburn Law then contacts him and says, who's Mr. Cooper's not a lawyer, contacts him and says, why don't you go through with this bankruptcy practice anyway? You can get on this total bankruptcy website. You'll get the same referrals that Bradburn did. I can be your office manager. You can be the lawyer. So for his this entire operation was open for 2 years, and he took in fees from clients and put them in his operating account because he believed that he was appropriate to do that. He also deposited into the operating account $116,000 that he borrowed from his parents. The two employees, he was the only lawyer. Mr. Cooper was the office manager, and he had some assistants and he had a lawyer for a couple of months, but other than that, he had no legal help. And he tried to operate three different offices at the same time he was learning bankruptcy law. So he did not go into this in an appropriate fashion. He was learning bankruptcy law while he was representing clients. But there are three separate cases, three separate citations in the record, page 54, page 80, and page 94, when he says, I didn't know there was no such thing as an earned on receipt fee. I didn't know I was doing anything wrong by depositing these fees into my operating account.
When did he go to law school?
1996. He started, graduated in 99.
What school did he go to?
I think he went to UC.
And they don't teach ethics there.
They obviously do. He was dead wrong. But is there corroborating evidence that this was negligence? He says, I was drinking from a fire hose. I was getting so many referrals, I was getting behind, I couldn't do it. So he does two things. He stops taking referrals from total bankruptcy, and he starts cutting down his pay. He's taking $1,100 a week at the beginning of 08 when this, or the middle of 08 when this starts. And
this all sounds like a great defense to a case, but hasn't your client been found guilty, and hasn't he sort of accepted responsibility? And
isn't, absolutely accepted responsibility.
And isn't he sort of remorseful in trying to make restitution? I'm stunned a man earning, as I hear this morning, over $100,000 hasn't paid some of these people back.
Well, it's all
has
timing.
Has your client made restitution to these folks?
It's timing, Your Honor. He was.
Can't hear you, sir.
I'm sorry. It's timing, Your Honor. He was unemployed for a year. He closed his law office. This started.
Is he earning more than $100,000 a year?
He's earning $80,000 a year, and he's getting Air Force retirement benefits that net him about $2,300 a month.
And is he paying these people back? Has he completed this restitution of these 30 clients?
Here's what he's doing. When he came, when this disciplinary case started, and when he came to me, he was unemployed, and his only funds were the $2,300 that he was getting from retirement. He contracted with Nick Zingarelli to pay Zingarelli directly from that bank account $1,000 a month. So he had $2,300 coming in and $1,000 going out. And he sent a letter, which is unlike anything any of us have ever seen. It's Exhibit D, which says, I was wrong. I've embarrassed myself and my profession. I violated your trust. Here's what I've done to try and make it right. You can go to Zingarelli. He'll do the finish-up work, and I'll pay him. Or if you don't want to do that, you can pick up your file and go to another lawyer. There's a client security fund that will repay you after I finish the disciplinary process, or I will repay you. So you've got three choices.
Well, the client security fund is paid by the registration fee of all the lawyers in Ohio. Is that his plan for restitution for
his
30 clients?
No, sir. And if the client security fund pays, he has to repay the client security fund. So at the time when he had no money, he hired Zingarelli, and he's paid him $1,000 every month since then. He began employment about 3 months before the hearing, and his testimony was, I'm putting aside $1,000 a month to offer to these clients who haven't gone with Zingarelli, and when I get finished paying Zingarelli, I'm going to take that $1,000 a month and add it to the first $1,000. So that's the state of the record.
Counsel, a dilemma, it seems to me, when we look at these, that the board recommends indefinite suspension, He can't get back in until full restitution is made. Are you here to object to that? Or
no.
So your client is prepared to accept that?
Yes.
As the outcome?
All we're asking for.
The bar's advocating disbarment. The dilemma that I see is I have difficulty comprehending what incentive your client has to make any further effort to repay the clients if he's disbarred.
I'm not arguing that. He's going to pay this money back anyway. He's paying the money back for two reasons. One is honor, which he testified to, which is the reason he wants the ability to come back to this court someday and ask for reinstatement after he proves he's made full reimbursement. And the second, more practical reason is if the client security fund pays, they're going to come after him. And he's employed now. So one way or the other, he's going to pay this money back. We're not asking for a term suspension. We're only asking that he have the ability to someday come back before this court, prove he's made restitution, prove that he has the fitness and character to practice law, and ask for readmission. He hasn't practiced since late 2010. And I think if you look at the fees that are on Exhibit D, you can see that he stopped accepting new clients well before this started. There are fees received in 2010 from clients that he signed up in 2008 and 2009, but nobody's first payment is in 2010. So he did a very poor job in choosing to go into an area of practice that he didn't know anything about. He didn't study up on the IOLTA accounts. There's absolutely no excuse for his behavior in terms of negligence. My only point is he's not a guy that's taking money from his client account to pay gambling debts or drinking or buy a new car. He's putting them into his operating account. He's trying to run a law office. And when he can't make it work, he quits. And he starts looking for a lawyer to take over these cases.
What does he do with Wright Pat?
He's a contracting officer. It's not a legal position, but he teaches junior officers how to enter into contracts on behalf of the Air Force. And his testimony was that he had no intention, no present intention of reentering the practice of law. But
he's still representing clients in bankruptcy now.
What the record was is that he had realized that he was still counsel of record for people who were paying according to plan, but he was not actively rendering any legal services. I'm pretty sure that has changed since then, but that information's not in the record.
What do you mean it's changed since then?
I think those Chapter 13 cases
are over with.
I think they've been moved to Mr. Zingarelli.
Oh, they have. So he's not appearing in court.
That's
either in Ohio or Kentucky.
That's my understanding. Not of record, but that's.
And if he is suspended here indefinitely, his Kentucky license will be suspended as well.
Yes, ma'am. The beauty of the disciplinary system is that it's not precedent tied. You have and exercise the ability to look at each particular circumstance, weigh the aggravating and mitigating circumstances, and the nature of the professional misconduct. The professional misconduct here is unusual. It's negligence, as I said, and not intentional misconduct. He reached out to his clients. He's made a diligent effort for restitution, which continues. And I do take umbrage with the statement that he had an opportunity to make full disclosure during his deposition and failed to take that. He was not asked a question, and he did not give an untruthful answer. You will see at page 94 of the transcript, they didn't ask him, are you keeping client funds in your trust account? He didn't say, yes, I am. The Bar Association's position is, while we had you under oath and while we were talking about this, you should have volunteered that you weren't keeping clients' funds in your trust account, which is true. If he had realized it was wrongful, he should have disclosed it, but he didn't. His testimony is, I didn't know at that time that I was operating inappropriately. These were flat fees. So it's inexcusable neglect, but it's different than theft. It's not intentional conduct. And we respectfully ask that he retain the opportunity to come before you in the future, prove himself, prove restitution, and ask for the ability to practice again. He testified that if he's allowed to practice, he would do so in a pro bono capacity to try and regain his honor. And honor is a very real thing for him. He's been in the military for 20 years, and I think the panel accepted his sincerity and his remorse, and I think that's reflected in the report and recommendation. If you have no other questions, thank you for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Gearing.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple points. The point was made by Mr. Johnson that this was not intentional conduct. I think we would take exception to that. If we start getting into categorizing conduct such as this as not being as being negligent, if you will, as opposed to intentional, I don't think that's the standard in number one. But where this court has said taking client funds, not putting them in a trust account, using them for your own purpose, attorney, that is tantamount to theft. To me, that becomes intentional.
Do you have any evidence that he spent this money on things other than running his office? I mean, did he have gambling issues? Did he have, sometimes you're trying to hide money from spouses, those sort of things. Do you have any evidence of that sort?
We do not, Your Honor. What we have is testimony in the transcript that he was taking draws from this money, that part of it went to pay himself, and I think the testimony was Mr. Cooper, who was the other individual in his office who he turned over the operation of his law office to under this bankruptcy practice. So, yes, we believe that it did go to him. It didn't go to some sort of other problem, child support or anything like that. This was for his own living expenses. But these were
You're
client funds.
As a fee.
This was money paid for filing fees, too. And clients never got their bankruptcies filed. And that makes it even more egregious. And I would point out, and I think one of the clients says it very, very clearly, and this is Exhibit M to the stipulations, and this is from a Mr. Brandenburg. And Mr. Brandenburg said, and I'm just summarizing, I'm reading his statement, Mr. Britt never filed a single document towards bankruptcy. He informed me to stop paying on all my credit cards, loans, etc. Now my credit is ruined and I still have to pay back all the creditors. And this is on 40 plus clients that this occurred. And certainly what this court has to do and what we do as a bar association when we come before you on a sanctioned issue is make a prediction. And what is the prediction? That if this attorney should be readmitted to the practice of law, given the other a chance after some indefinite suspension, after restitution, what will happen in terms of risk to the public? And in our view, based upon the pattern here, the history, his inability to run a law office, to recognize ethical issues, that we believe the public is at risk and can be harmed, and that's why we're asking for disbarment. And unless you have any questions, thank you very much.
Thank you. Gentlemen, we will take the matter under advisement. You'll be notified of our decision.